If men were writing the Bible, that is, writing it apart from the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, the aspect of Noah's life that we're going to look at tonight would surely be a part of his life story that would have been omitted. Humanly speaking, I think we would much prefer the story of the great man of faith, Noah, to end in a grand and glorious way. And yet that's not how his story ends. Were it up to us, perhaps we would have preferred that the editor just sort of scratch out these particular verses from the manuscript of the book of Genesis before it went to the printer. But the Bible always portrays its characters in their true colors. The most prominent heroes in the Bible are often shown in honest and frank ways, even when it comes to their sins. It's been said that to err is human, and we may well add to that, it's also human for us to want to cover up the blemishes of those that we admire. Surely, if this had simply been the product of an uninspired historian, this section of Genesis would have either been minimized or totally ignored, or if it had been recorded as it is here, there would be an accompanying attempt to rationalize or to excuse what takes place here. After the judgment, the great judgment of the flood and the salvation of Noah and his family, the survivors step out of the ark with the reassurance of a divine covenant, a promise that God would never again flood the earth, and he symbolizes that, provides a sign of that promise in the form of a rainbow. Regularly in our study, especially of the account of the flood itself, we have seen allusions to the first couple of chapters of Genesis. And thus, in the flood, what we are seeing is a reversal, if you will, of creation itself. That God has returned the earth back to a place of watery chaos. It was, in a sense, formless and void. And he now, in the days of Noah, looks to recreate a functional world. When Noah and his family, along with the animals, exit the ark, God is starting over again. He is reestablishing a new creation, and in that sense, Noah becomes a second Adam, if you will. And it will be from his sons that all of the people on earth will be descended, including you and I. Yes, God used the flood to bring judgment upon humanity, but Noah's survival communicates something in clear terms. That God has not given up on his creation, that he continues to love those whom he had made, and he seeks to bring about their blessing and their welfare. But the looming question after the flood is, will humanity be any different than they were before it? That in light of such a catastrophic event, will men now choose to obey God? Will they decide to live and to act righteously? Or will this new group of humanity simply revert to the same pattern of sin that had become such a large part of the pre-flood world? Where the flood account itself parallels much of Genesis chapters 1 and 2, this section that we're going to look at tonight parallels the fall of man in Genesis chapter 3. And in so doing, it reveals that at least from a spiritual standpoint, the future of humanity is not the brightest. Here we find an account of drunkenness, of immodesty, of family embarrassment, of the eventual uttering of a curse. And that curse will be uttered not against the actual perpetrator, but against the perpetrator's son. It's a rather unusual narrative, and it results in some perplexing questions that have plagued students of the Bible for centuries. Why is Noah portrayed so negatively here at the end of his life? What exactly did Ham do to his dad? And what was it why is Canaan cursed for something that it seems he didn't even do? Throughout the life of Noah, and really throughout the book of Genesis as a whole, there have been an emphasis on two significant elements, and that is blessing or cursing. And those same two elements are prominent in the text we're going to look at tonight. Now, we're not given a specific time frame as to when these things occur, but whatever we're about to read certainly would have happened at a lengthy period of time following their departure from the ark. And we see that reflected in the fact that there is going to be several references to Canaan, one of the youngest sons born to Ham, one of Noah's three sons. And therefore, since none of those grandsons of Noah were on the ark, there were only his three sons and their wives, there is an indication here that a period of time has passed to allow Ham to father at least four sons, and it seems Canaan being the youngest of them. Let's read, if you would, beginning in verse 18. Genesis chapter 9, verse 18, beginning. Now the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah woke from his wine, he knew that what his youngest son had done to him. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." Noah lived 350 years after the flood, so all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. I suppose we could have actually used this text for our Father's Day lesson this morning, couldn't we, since there's a lot about focusing on fathers there. It starts, first of all, with verses 18 and 19. And here we're simply told about Noah and his three sons. They've been named for us on three previous occasions in our study. Chapter 5 and verse 32, chapter 6 and verse 10, chapter 7 and verse 13. And it seems that here they are reintroduced to us to supply us with some important background information to clarify, especially the account that follows, particularly the reference to Ham's son, Canaan. It is told to us that from these three men, the whole earth is populated. Literally in the Hebrew, the word is scattered. And it seems that that word, the use of that word, anticipates the dispersal of mankind throughout the world. What we will, if we were to continue studying from the book of Genesis, we would come across, obviously, in Genesis chapter 11. And so we find this movement from there being three men, the sons of Noah, to now the whole earth being scattered, if you will, and thus in fulfillment of the command that was given to Noah in chapter 9 and verse 1 and in verse 7 to be fruitful and to multiply, and it seems that mankind is taking that seriously. In verses 20 through 23, we find the second component of the story, and that's the element of drinking and dishonor. The account begins with a reference to Noah and the New American Standard. I'm not a fan of how they phrase this, that he began farming. Literally, he is described as a man of the soil, a man of the earth. And again, we see this echo of the early chapters of Genesis, that he is a man of the earth in a similar way as what's that guy that was married to Eve? Adam. Drew a blank there for a second. We see this allusion to Adam, that he too was a cultivator of the ground. But there's more implied here. It doesn't just say that Noah was a farmer. The terminology that's used in the past is that they were a cultivator of the soil, or, for example, Cain was a tiller of the soil. Here it's a different description. He is described as a man of the soil, a man of the earth. And that word, earth or soil, has been a significant word to this point in the book of Genesis. It is from the dust of the soil or the earth that man comes, Genesis 2 and verse 7. It is the soil of the earth that is cursed as a result of man's sin, chapter 3 and verse 17. It is the dust of the earth to which men return when they die, chapter 3 and verse 19. It is the same word that's used to describe the earth that is doomed and is flooded, and that then God promises to never destroy again. Same thing, same word. It seems that this description of the man of the earth reminds us, first of all, that he is mortal, but secondly, that he must continue to struggle to survive in the face of an earth that is under the curse because of human sin. That just as God had told to Adam that he would make a living from the toil of his brow, that he would battle the thorns and the thistles, that Noah is following in that same pathway, that the curse has not been removed in that sense. Not only does Noah plant something, but we're told specifically he plants a vineyard. And then we're told that he becomes inebriated as a result of its produce. Now there is a great deal that's written about that particular aspect of Noah's actions. You'll notice that the text doesn't explain, the text doesn't excuse, nor does the text condemn Noah for what he does here. That, however, is not to say that there is no explanation, there is no excuse given, and there is no condemnation uttered. It simply means that the writer of Genesis, Moses, is not looking to be deterred from what he sees as his primary purpose in recording this, and that is to not so much focus on what Noah does, but rather to focus his attention on what Ham does. Again, we hear these echoes, don't we, from the fall of man in Genesis chapter 3. Both accounts begin by involving people who are at least initially unaware of their own nakedness. Both of them involve accounts where there is a partaking of fruit or something from fruit. And both of them, after the partaking of the fruit, realize or see something of their or become naked. Adam and Eve, when they partake of the fruit, you remember their eyes were open and now they look to cover themselves. They now see their nakedness. Now remember that Noah is a man who, we have been told prior to this, walked with God. That Noah is a man who did all that the Lord had commanded him concerning the building and the boarding and the exiting of the ark. That this is the same man who trusted God in faithful obedience when much of the world around him was dark and disordered. This is the same man who, when he exits the ark, offers a burnt offering to God. Several of them, in fact. And thus signifies his total devotion to God. And this is the same man who has received a covenant promise from God. And yet now we see this same God-fearing man described as a drunk who's lying naked in his tent. Understand here, Noah is not some young, inexperienced saint. He's 600 years old when the flood comes. He's already demonstrated great spiritual strength in his faithfulness in the midst of a world that had gone crazy in its pursuit of evil. And yet here we find this seasoned saint who falls. Some scholars say that the contrast between the Noah prior to this and this particular Noah is so incongruous that it surely can't be talking about the same man. There are others who say that it's talking about the same man, but it's written by two different pens, that it's not the same author who described these two different Noahs. But I think it's the same Noah, and I think it's precisely the same Noah that's what we are supposed to see. That even after the flood, God chapter 8 and verse 21 recognized that man's heart, the intentions of man's hearts were evil from his youth. That God saved Noah and his family from the flood, and yet the reality is that Noah and his sons are still people, and they're still prone to fall. That even people of great faith, like Noah, sin. And that continues to be true today, doesn't it? That just because we're people of faith, just because we become a Christian, doesn't guarantee us a pathway of instant holiness. It simply is the beginning of a journey to greater, hopefully greater holiness and growth. That the life of the faithful person faces all kinds of pitfalls in life, And sometimes we stand and other times we fall. That no great achievement in the past guarantees something in terms of victory in the future. And thus, this part of Noah's story is incredibly relevant to all of us. It is intended to communicate to us the fact that there is no such thing as a perfect saint. The only perfect person to ever live was Jesus. And as great as Noah was, as faithful as Noah was, as courageous as Noah was, Noah falls. What was intended to be a blessing in terms of the fruit becomes a source of temptation. And that source of temptation, rather than him standing firm against it, yields to it and allows it to control him. I found it interesting that in my reading in preparation for this, that there are some writers who completely exonerate Noah here. There are others who, though they don't come right out and approve what Noah does, they don't criticize him. And they certainly don't condemn him. One writer put it this way. He said, Noah is not the culprit in this story. Drinking alcohol is not a sin. It is enjoying God's gift to humanity. It is hard to argue that getting drunk is in and of itself a sin. We'll talk about it here in just a second here. Certainly Noah is not hurting anyone. Not that this is the only criterion of sin as he lies naked in his tent. Noah is not the guilty party. Notice he is never punished. Ham is. There's parts of that I would agree with. And there's a lot of it I would disagree with. Because had Noah not gotten drunk, he never would have passed out naked in his tent. And Ham would have never been able to see or to do to his dad what he sees or does. Now that's not to say that what Ham did was Noah's fault. What it does mean is that Noah didn't do anything to prevent Ham's actions. That while you can't blame Noah for what Ham does, you can't also say that, well, Noah didn't do anything wrong either. Because if he's not drunk, he's not naked in his tent, and Ham doesn't see him. The Bible is filled with a number of warnings about the dangers of alcohol. And here we see two of the degrading effects that are connected to it. The first one being drunkenness. By the way, this is the first mention of wine in the Bible. Isn't that interesting? Because from its very first reference, we see the trappings of depravity. The cursing and the slavery that it results in, not celebration and joy. That in some sense, this new humanity that begins with Noah, in reality just parallels the old humanity that preceded the flood. In light of all of its evils and issues associated with the consumption of alcohol, and by the way, let me add this caveat here, that what Noah drank was nothing in terms of the alcoholic content of what beverages are today. In light of all of the problems and issues connected to it, our society not only approves it, it promotes it, it glorifies it, it glamorizes it. The second thing is mentioned is the fact that he uncovered himself. It's a word in the Hebrew that typically carries with it an element of disgrace. It's often connected with immoral behavior. This is a different word than what is used in Genesis 2 and verse 25, where it describes for us that Adam and Eve were naked and were not ashamed. It's not the same word. Alcohol is a way of diminishing a person's inhibitions. We will see, if we were to continue studying Genesis, we'd see a great example of that in Genesis chapter 19 with Lot and his two daughters who get him drunk in order to commit incest with him, in order to carry on the family name, if you will. It seems clear to me that whatever Noah does here in terms of uncovering himself, that it was something that he would not have done if he had been in a sober state. Without dismissing or diminishing Noah's actions, from what follows, the writer clearly draws a bead on the actions of Noah's son. That part is true. That the focus of the text, without letting Noah off the hook, the focus of the text really is on his son Ham, who does two things in verse 22. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Saw his father's nakedness. What does that mean? It's interesting. If you'll notice in verse 24, it says there that Noah knew what his youngest son had done to him. And the combination here of passages has led a number of scholars to read a lot of extra things into the text. All that we're really told is that he saw his father's nakedness. And yet some accuse him of committing incest with his mother, others engaging in homosexual activity with his dad. And it even gets worse than that, and I'll spare you this. Those are all obvious stretches in my mind from what we are told in the text. And in my mind, they are also disproved by what his brothers do in the very next verse. They perform their actions specifically for the purpose of not seeing their father's nakedness. Throughout the ancient world, honoring one's parents was viewed as a sacred duty. And thus what Ham does here is not only improper and inappropriate, it is incredibly disrespectful. We can only conclude that what Ham saw here was not some accidental glimpse. This was not a case of him just happening to pull back the tent flap and see something accidentally. That whatever happened here, it was something that was impure. Something that, in terms of how he observed his father or the gaze with which he appeared upon his father. And here we find another echo of the fall of man in Genesis chapter 3, in that both Eve and Ham are led into sin as a result of their eyes, what they see. The second wrong that he does is that instead of keeping the matter to himself, instead of just covering up his dad quietly and not saying anything to anyone else, he goes and without discretion broadcasts it to his brothers. And some suggest that what he was trying to do is to get his brothers to do the very same thing he had done. If that was indeed the case, then he fails. Because his brothers respond appropriately by going to great efforts and engaging in what would have been a rather awkward procedure in order to cover up their dad in such a way that it prohibits them from seeing what Ham saw. In fact, twice the writer mentions that they walked backwards. The phrase there in the New American Standard, turned away, literally is the word backwards. And so they each put part of the cloak on their shoulder and they back up in what must have been a rather tricky operation to pull off. And yet they took these steps to preserve the honor of their dad. They exercised great caution. They were motivated by discretion and sensitivity, the opposite attitude that was demonstrated by him. And you have to imagine that their action served as a rather stern rebuke to the actions of their brother. What follows in verses 24 through 27 in terms of the cursing and the blessing is that when Noah wakes up, he's aware, we're told, of what his youngest son had done to him. And how he discovered that, it's never stated to us. What we are told specifically about are the consequences that were attached to Ham's act of profaning what was sacred, of treating with dishonor what he was supposed to have honored. And here in verse 25, as long as we've been studying Noah, these are the first recorded words of Noah since we were introduced to him. And surprisingly, even though Ham is the one who violated his father's honor, the curse is actually pronounced upon Canaan, Ham's son, his youngest son. And that fact presents a little bit of a difficulty. And there are some answers, or the answers aren't quite as obvious to us. It seems that the best solution in verse 25 through verse 27 is that what we have here is a patriarchal pronouncement, very similar to later in the book in Genesis chapter 49 when Jacob makes a patriarchal pronouncement about all of his sons. That's what we have here, that the sons of Noah embody and personify the qualities that will be obvious in their descendants. As Moses writes this, remember that he is writing it not in the days of Noah, but he is writing it hundreds of years later, and he is writing it to Israel and for the nation of Israel. And it seems that what he is doing is very early on in the Genesis record, he is showing that those who have descended from Canaan, who will ultimately be the greatest source of temptation to God's people within the land of Canaan, are simply following after the pattern of some of their descendants. The Canaanites will often be engaged in drunkenness and immorality associated with their religious practices, and Moses is going to emphasize to them that those behaviors must always be avoided. In fact, keep your place here in Genesis. Look at Leviticus chapter 18. Look at what Moses writes in Leviticus 18 in regard to the law. He says, in chapter 18 of Leviticus, verse 1, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you live, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes, to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments, by which a man may live if he does them. I am the Lord.'" Then notice verse 6. "None of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord." And by the way, there are 24 uses of the word nakedness from verse 7 going down through verse 23. It seems that Noah's curse on Canaan represents the sentence on the sins of the Canaanites, which their forefather, Ham, has himself exemplified. That Ham has acted in a certain way, certain actions, certain attitudes, those will be carried over in the form of his son Canaan, and those will be carried over in the form of Canaan's descendants after him, that when by the time the Israelites are about to enter into the promised land and the sin of the Canaanites has come to a place where God now can bring judgment upon them, that what is being told here is the Israelites are to understand that Ham, in a sense, is alive and well in them. This is not a case of Canaan being punished for his father's crimes. This is a situation where Noah is anticipating that Canaan is going to follow in the footsteps of his dad, and that those who come from Ham, thus Canaan and others, will possess the same evil traits that marked their father, their predecessor. In fact, the names of the three sons in this particular section don't represent so much the individual men themselves, but instead represent the people, the descendants that will come after them. That everything that the Canaanites did in their pagan existence is going to be a reflection and will stretch far beyond the attitudes and the actions of their predecessor, Ham. Now you'll notice that the curse that is brought on Canaan in verse 25 is that he will be a servant of servants. This is a familiar way of phrasing superlatives in the ancient world. King of kings, Lord of lords, he will be a servant of servants. And the point is that this is a way of describing that the descendants of Canaan will experience the most abject slavery. They will be the absolute lowest of slaves, and that they will be slaves, he says, to his brothers. And what we can take away from that is that sin only lowers and it only limits. The sin never lifts anyone up. It only brings us down further, and it doesn't provide freedom. Instead, it always enslaves. And here's another challenging aspect, and that is how and when did all of this come true? But when were the descendants of Cain slaves to Shem and Japheth's descendants? It's easy to see, at least to some degree, the dominance of one, that when Israel comes into the promised land, the descendants of Shem, and they overpower the Canaanites and in some degree make them forced laborers, according to the opening chapters of the book of Judges. It's easy to see that one. It's not so easy to see when Japheth's descendants ruled over Canaan's descendants. While Noah curses Canaan, he blesses Shem and Japheth. And the wording is interesting to Shem in that he makes it the Lord, not so much Shem, that is the object of blessing. Noah is blessing the Lord for being the God of Shem. And here we see this indication that the messianic line is ultimately going to come through that son of Noah. There's also a play on words in terms of Japheth. May God enlarge Japheth. Japheth means enlarge. And there's an expression of hope that God is going to make the descendants of Japheth increase. But also there is added that he will dwell in the tents of Shem, another conundrum in terms of when does this transpire? Some believe it takes place in the days of the monarchy of David when the Canaanites are subdued and the Philistines, who are Japheth's descendants, are also incorporated into David's empire. There are others who suggest that this is a spiritual reference. That in the comings and goings of humanity throughout history, that there would come a time when outsiders, the descendants of Japheth, would dwell in the tents of Shem, the chosen ones, that is looking forward to the gospel age. The pronouncement section closes with a third reference to Canaan's future enslavement. Thus it is emphatic, it is certain. He is enslaved to his own vices, and therefore he will be enslaved to others. Were it not for God's changed logic, you'll remember that man's depravity has now become a ground for mercy following the flood rather than grounds for judgment. Had it been a grounds for judgment at this point in time, we could see that humanity is beginning to again wander off of the path, and they will keep, if they were to keep heading in that direction, then there's going to come another deluge. But God promised there would not be. And so here we now find sinful man sustained by grace rather than suffering God's wrath, and in that he is able to face the future with security instead of fear. The flood had destroyed the old world, and out of it had been born this new creation, and yet the sinfulness of humanity becomes evident not only in Noah's life, but one of Noah's sons' lives. And yet you'll notice here that instead of Ham's sin affecting everybody in the world, there is instead the disadvantages that fall to one group, his family, his descendants. And we're now beginning to set the stage for what will happen in chapter 12, where there is a family that is going to be the line of the Messiah in Abraham, and they will be blessed, and through him we will be blessed as well. The end of the record of Noah's life comes to a conclusion in much the same way as the genealogies had that we started with back a number of weeks ago in Genesis 5 and verse 3 and following. He was 600 years old when the flood came. He lived another 350 years before that flood came. Only two men lived longer than Noah: Jared, 962 years, and Methuselah, 969. And yet here we find, at the end of verse 29, that he followed the same pattern as all of the descendants before him, with the exception of Enoch, in that he died. He was a faithful man. He was an obedient man. But he still died. Noah was just a mortal. As great a man as he was just a man. The account of the flood describes a catastrophic event in which God proves his hatred for sin. But he also, at the same time, offers a message of comfort as he saves men, Noah and his family, in spite of man's incorrigible perversity toward evil. That moving forward, God continues to uphold the present nature and order of the world. He promises he will never flood the earth again as a result of man's sin. And therefore, in that, the righteous are provided with assurance that it is those who walk with God, it is those who, like Noah, choose to obey God's instruction, they are the ones who will be preserved from judgment in that last day. They are the ones who will experience eternal life. And tonight, you're in one of two categories. You're either in a group of people who are heading for divine judgment, or you are in a group of people that are heading for divine blessing. And tonight, as we close, the choice is yours. Which group do you want to be a part of? I think everyone would say, "Well, I want to be in the blessing group." But that choice must result in action. It must result in determination and resolve. It must result in commitment. And tonight, we invite you, as we close, to make a commitment to God, to become a part of His family, to not put it off another moment, but to obey the gospel of Jesus, and become a part of the redeemed. Can we help you to do that? We invite you right now. Come, won't you, as we stand and sing.